separation of church and state, unless it follows the progressive left agenda. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principled Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaelis.
Great to be back with you here in the studio. Studio such as it is, it's my kitchen.
Well, that's okay. It is still a studio. Yes, we're taping this a little bit ahead of time. Everybody's all a Twitter, at least in certain parts of the world.
So to speak. Nyuk, nyuk, nyuk.
So to speak, yeah, even on Twitter. Because the Pope has come to America. Pope Francis, the current reigning pontiff of the Catholic Church, has started his, I think it's a five or six day visit, where he has met with President Obama, and there have been a number of receptions. And also on the day here that we're taping this, he has met before a joint session of Congress. Now, this is interesting because, you know, you've had other people like Benjamin Netanyahu from Israel and others who have met in front of joint sessions of Congress. But I find it interesting in this particular respect, in that this particular invitation really goes a long way toward debunking this whole liberal mantra of separation of church and state. Because would it not be, at least in the liberal mindset, Charles, a violation of that deeply held and constitutional tradition that we have in this country of making sure that church and state are not intermingled?
Okay, it only applies when liberal pundits want it to apply.
Well, now, there is that.
I'm going to give you an example. If you recall, in the late 80s, maybe mid-80s, I'm trying to remember the exact dates.
Okay.
Jesse Jackson ran for president.
I do remember that.
The Reverend Jesse Jackson.
The Reverend Jackson.
And he made direct political appeals in churches.
Yes, he did.
Now, at the same time, Reverend Pat Robertson also ran for president.
Yes.
Was not allowed to make direct political appeals in churches. Now, why? Well, the IRS looked the other way while Jackson was doing it and told Robertson that if he did it, they were going to clamp down on the churches. Okay, well, there's a double standard, rather clearly. This idea of the separation of church and state, let's talk about that for a minute. There is no such thing as the separation of church and state as a phrase in the United States Constitution. The idea also is not there. The idea is that the churches are allowed to have as much influence as they can muster on the political sphere. We can run reverends as candidates. We can run elders as candidates. We can run vestrymen as candidates. We can run deacons as candidates. We can run members of churches as candidates. And they're allowed to use their faith to guide their decisions, despite the fact that groups like Americans United for Separation of Church and State and Freedom from Religion Foundation and those groups say the contrary. Why is that allowed? Well, it's very clear in Article 1 that Congress shall make no law establishing a national, you know, a establishing a religion.
Establishment of religion, yes.
Nor creating a law restricting the free exercise thereof.
Right, exactly. So in other words, we're not going to have a national church.
Right.
But we're also not going to allow there to be laws passed to say that you can't worship to the dictates of your conscience how you choose. Now, it's interesting because that means that what that really is saying in the First Amendment is government is not going to interfere or play favorites with faith. At least that's the way our founders
interpreted it. That's the way they understood it.
However, over the succeeding 228 years, what you've had happen is courts pulling phrases out of letters sent by
Thomas Jefferson yeah.
to say, oh, no, that means that we can't mention God at all in relation to the civic arena, in shorthand. However, we can create all kinds of other false gods, secular humanism, socialism, atheism, you name it.
Scientism.
We can do all of that. That's not a problem. And I think it's interesting because yet when the Pope arrived here yesterday morning, and like I said, we're taping this on the Thursday of the week he's in town.
Right.
There was a great, public welcome and a speech given by President Barack Obama. And basically he said, and this is the interesting thing, because if he really meant it the way the First Amendment meant it, i.e. the way the founders meant it, this would be a great statement. But knowing what how President Obama himself and the Obama administration has been treating religious liberty issues, I think that there's an awful lot of inference that you can make into his statements. And he says, in his speech welcoming Pope Francis, he said that the U.S. cherishes and must defend religious liberty. Now, it's funny. He's saying that at the same time while he's allowing someone like Kim Davis to go to be brought in front of a federal judge and go to jail for upholding her religious liberty, for putting in place a law, which is not a law, the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, which in its own provisions violates the consciences of many Catholic believers with paying for abortions and all of the things that were in the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act that the administration has been sued over time and time again. But he says here, and this is the quote that I think is hilarious. You remind us, he's talking about the Pope, you remind us people are only truly free when they can practice their faith freely.
Wow.
Yes.
Well, okay. But it's very typical, especially of this administration, of the open doublespeak. And for those of you who have never read 1984, first of all, shame on you. Second of all, go pick up a copy. But doublespeak is essentially what people in officialdom and semi-officialdom, in fact, the protagonist, his name is Winston Smith, and Winston Smith's job is in the Ministry of Information. And what Winston Smith did was go through, now this shows you how dated 1984 is. He would go through newspaper and magazine articles.
It's at least 31 years old, though.
And yeah, that's right. And he would cut out the names of people who had been disappeared by the government or had fallen into disgrace. And he would put them in a little vacuum-fed thing at his desk called the memory hole. And things would go down the memory hole into a furnace and be burned. So there was no trace of information left that this person had ever existed. Or it was essentially a parody of Joseph Stalin having people who he'd had executed airbrushed out of official photographs, some of which are actually kind of funny because if you look at them really closely, you can see Joseph Stalin shaking a hand of a person that isn't there, has been completely airbrushed out, and the person behind him has been filled in, but there's no hand attached to a body. So he's got a hand in his hand.
So, well, C.S. Lewis talked about men without chests.
That's right.
And I think he was talking along the same lines, and that's people who don't stand on any principles.
Exactly.
And it's, and I wanted to weave in C.S. Lewis into this as a Catholic writer.
Well, actually, he was an Anglican.
No, that's right. Lewis was the Anglican. It was Tolkien who was the Catholic.
That's right.
But here's the interesting catch, and we're going to talk a little bit more about where the Pope stands on a lot of these issues. But here we have the President of the United States standing up in front of the Pope, in front of the American people, and he's singing this song that, you know, we're only free when we practice our faith freely. And he says this, he followed up with this quote, "Here in the United States, we cherish religious liberty." And you know what? He's absolutely right, because the people of the United States do cherish religious liberty and religious freedom. We're not allowed to operate that way now in the new regime. We have what we call higher order priorities, such as homosexual rights, such as not offending or not criticizing someone for being Muslim. As Ben Carson has found out, and when they tried to play the gotcha game with him over whether or not he believes that he would vote for a Muslim for president. Well, you know what? Ben was absolutely right in his response to that, and I think it's starting to show. But then here's the other thing Obama said, and this is where, you know, you see the underpinnings of the real agenda starting to show. And he says this, he says, quote, "So we stand with you in defense of religious freedom and interfaith dialogue."
Oh, boy.
Ding, 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 ding.
Yeah.
"Knowing that people everywhere must be able to live out their faith free from fear and free from intimidation," unquote. Really? Is that what the message that his Justice Department sent to, photographers in New Mexico, cake bakers in Oregon, and county clerks in Kentucky?
Well, that's my whole point on this, on the doublespeak thing. Doublespeak basically meant saying one thing and meaning something entirely different.
That's exactly what he's doing.
That's what Winston Smith and everybody in the book 1984 had to deal with. Because what he really means is, you can practice your faith within the parameters set by the federal government, rather than the federal government has to work within the faith parameters of its citizens. There is a vast difference there. There is a fundamental philosophical difference on what the United States government is supposed to be, but that's nothing new, especially with this regime. At least, let's be clear about it. The Obama administration is more honest about its philosophical ideas of the underpinnings of government than any administration that has come before it.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are a number of administrations that have come before it that have the same ideas. At least, let's say similar ideas, in that basically government can do whatever it wants to do, and the only governments that are actually limited by the Constitution are the state governments. An absurdity. Because the Constitution was written specifically to limit the federal government's powers. Well, these guys, this is nothing new. This goes back as far as the turn of the century. The idea that the federal government has unlimited power. And it goes back to 1865.
Yes, it does.
So we've been dealing with this now for 150 years. This is the kind of doublespeak that you get. People have to be free to exercise their freedom unless it interferes with the erotic freedom of someone else or the behavioral freedom of someone else that is found offensive. The fact is that Barack Obama doesn't really believe that everyone has to be free to exercise their religious liberties.
Well, you know, that's okay, Chuck, because really, when it gets right down to it, I'm not sure that the Pope completely believes that either. And I know we're going to get some pushback from some of our Catholic listeners. That's perfectly fine. That's not a problem. But we have a situation where you have the Pope that today, as we're recording this today, the Pope is speaking before a joint session of Congress, And in that, the Pope is putting forth some of the ideas of redistribution of wealth, social justice, and all of the progressive mantras, but he's staying away from things like our belief in the sanctity of life, the belief of traditional marriage. It's really quite disturbing, Charles, that we've got this situation here where, you know, this pontiff, this pope, is really carrying on a political agenda of his very own in front of a joint session of Congress. Now, he lectured not just Congress, but all of America, which means you and me and our listeners as well, how that we need to be more soft on illegal immigration, you know, because, you know, we're supposed to help the poor and the needy, right, Chuck? And of course, a standard Catholic position of opposition to the death penalty,
which is non-biblical
in any shape or form, which is non-biblical. And he also wanted to tell us about how we needed to be more responsible on climate change. Now, if I remember correctly, weather is under the control of God Almighty, right? Not the Pope. Not the president, and certainly not the Congress.
Well, and not the American military, as some people have been trying, or the Russian military, as some people have been trying to claim for, 30 years. Were there efforts to try to harness the weather? Yeah, there were. Were they successful? No, they were not. So, yes. Okay.
So when the Pope was talking to Congress, he kind of started off by basically saying that, hey, I'm from the Western Hemisphere, too. As he said, he is a son of this great continent. Well,
no, he's not.
He's actually not. He's a son of the Southern continent, South America, not North America. And he says, and we've received so much from this great continent and which we share a common responsibility. Now, he didn't mention anybody else, any other countries, and what responsibility they have. It's just basically that America has all the responsibility for the entire continent.
Well, we're the biggest boy on the block, and therefore it's our job to make sure that all the little boys are protected and fed and clothed and housed. And no, it's not.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's also that because he was trying to make a point, and Chuck, I think that what he's saying is, he would like to take an Institute on the Constitution course from us. Because what he did say was that congressional authority sprang from the need to pursue the common good. Now, I understand that there is a general welfare clause in our Constitution, but I don't think the Pope understands that the genesis of congressional authority is from the granting of that authority by the consent of the people of this country. Now, by that he means common good, okay, he's using a different dictionary or a different vocabulary in order to get the same point across, maybe. But I don't think he means quite that.
Okay, this is equivocation written large, okay, because this next line, legislative activity is always based on care for the people. No, that's not what legislative activity is based on. Legislative activity is based on protecting the right of the people to care for themselves and one another.
Mm-hmm. Because in that respect, in the latter definition, that is the nexus of a constitutional representative republic.
Right.
The Pope's definition is the nexus and definition of socialism, where government is responsible for the care of the people. You see, that you have to be careful, ladies and gentlemen, to hear what they're saying, not hear what they're saying. Because you understand that there are two contexts involved. There is the spoken word, and then there's the unspoken meaning.
Right.
And in this context, the Pope's unspoken meaning is that government has the responsibility to, quote, care for the people, unquote. Well, Chuck, that's wonderful to say because that absolves the church of their responsibility. that absolves the individual and family of their responsibility. Wow. You know what? That sounds to me like that's a that is a nice, neat package, isn't it? Let's just absolve all our responsibility and hand it over to government. What's wrong with that picture, Charles?
Everything, because government doesn't have the resources, the time, the energy, the ability.
It doesn't even matter if it doesn't have all that. What does matter is they don't have legitimate jurisdiction to do that.
That's right. Who does?
Well, again, the family and the church.
The individual first, the individual and the church, because the church is made of individuals.
Oh, sure. And families. Yes.
And families.
And in God's economy, in his scriptures, which I hope the Pope has paid some attention to, maybe being upon the highest religious authority in the Catholic world, that there are legitimate jurisdictions that God established. And civil government is one of them, yes. But if we understand it, it was to reward good and to punish evil, not to care for the people. Because the care for the people, the caring for widows and orphans, was for the church. And the care for those who are your children and who are your family members is the families, not the governments. So, you know, constitutionally he's wrong, and biblically
he's wrong
in this respect.
Well, now you're in, now okay, this is where our Catholic, Roman Catholic friends will differ.
And that's why some of them will, some of them won't.
This is a spiritual issue.
Yes, it is.
And therefore the Pope is supposed to be infallible. Okay. The infallibility doctrine only goes back to about 1870, and supposedly it's only actually been invoked once. However, I think that's disingenuous. The Pope is considered infallible in spiritual statements. The problem being that other popes have issued decrees that are 180 degrees contradictory to sitting popes all the time. So was the Pope infallible then, or is he infallible now? Or did God change his mind? See, that there's the problem you run into.
Yes.
Well, you do run into that. It was okay then, but it's not okay now, and God changed his mind between here and now, and therefore, no, that's not the way this works. The Bible says what it says. God's law is what it is. It doesn't change.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. But if you are speaking or acting outside the bounds of the Bible, outside, and you're speaking from tradition and you're speaking from new revelation, then you can get to these points. Especially if you are admixing the orthodoxy of Scripture with the, the heresy of the social gospel. And it is, because what it does is it throws the Bible out on its ear, says God doesn't mean what he says he says, and that we need to use the power of government in order to equalize everybody's condition. Because that's the way you love people, is through government wealth redistribution. And you know, the Pope has kind of went there in his speech. You know, he talks about this idea, and I know that you know this word, but I'm sure our listeners probably don't know it as well. He said this because he was talking about, you know, he first talked about Moses and his role in the Bible, and then he's talked about, you know, having to care for the poor, the elderly, and the youth, and he cites Lincoln, Martin Luther King, Dorothy Day, and Thomas Merton. An interesting admix, but then he says something about Lincoln, and he talked about his legacy, and he says, building a future of freedom. Remember, we just talked about how the Constitution was basically thrown on its ear after 1865, requires love of the common good and cooperation in a spirit of subsidiarity and solidarity. Now, there's the key buzzword, Chuck.
Yeah.
Subsidiarity. Which is really a Catholic concept, and it's something that in the 20th century was popularized by Catholic writers Hilaire Belloc and by G.K. Chesterton. And basically what that is that there has to be institutions that take over the care of the poor, the elderly and the young, and that they have to work in cooperation with each other. In other words, the government and the church. But the church has to be the controlling force.
Well, okay. This is the basis for something that got really popular, three, four, 5 years ago,
mm-hmm.
called distributism.
Yes, that was very popular.
And I can remember people in our Constitution classes saying, you need to read Hilaire Belloc and G.K. Chesterton. They gave me the Servile State, and I'm trying to remember the other book. So I went down, I had a Kindle then, and I downloaded a copy, and I read it, and I'm like, well, okay. First of all, I said, socialism run by the church isn't any better than socialism run by the state. It's still socialism. It won't work. And I said, I think you've misread G.K. Chesterton. Because G.K. Chesterton was coming out, he wasn't railing against capitalism. We kept telling me how he was railing against capitalism. I said, I read it. He was not railing against capitalism. He was railing against British corporatism. British corporatism is anything but capitalistic. It's price fixed. It's what used to be called mercantilism. In other words, it was government-private partnerships. And actually, what G.K. Chesterton was railing against in British corporatism was the forerunner to Italian fascism. So I told him, I said, guess what? I'm with Chesterton on this. I don't like corporatism either, but I am a free market capitalist. And it sounds like he is too, from what I read of Chesterton. Oh, you misunderstood. And I said, well, I don't think so, because I've led a lot of the precursors that led up to this. I think perhaps you misunderstood, because you're the one who came to me and said Chesterton was yelling about capitalism when in fact what he was yelling about was corporatism. Those are not the same thing by any stretch of the imagination. So we have to understand our terms here. And the Pope is doing his best to equivocate. Now, he's talked about this subsidiarity.
Mm-hmm.
And what he means is basically, if you look, okay, at full disclosure, Barry and I are both Presbyterian. Presbyterianism is a bottom-up church government.
Yeah.
In other words, it's grassroots. Essentially, the congregation runs the administration of the church, and we go to the presbytery for certain guidance on spiritual matters and that kind of thing, on how to hire pastors and,
mm-hmm.
in fact, if in Presbyterianism, the pastor is not actually a member of the congregation, he's a member of the presbytery.
Right, exactly.
Now, what that does?
It's called divided sovereignty.
Divided sovereignty, exactly. That way, if it becomes a problem, he can move around inside the presbytery. Because congregations can go nuts and pastors can go nuts, and when a pastor goes nuts, he's subject to discipline by the presbytery, not by the congregation. So that being said, Catholicism, Anglicanism, a number of that style of government are top-down style governments. In other words, things are handed down from a bishop, or in the case of the Catholic Church, a pope. Decrees are handed down. Things do not move up from the grassroots into the hierarchy. They move from the hierarchy down to the grassroots. So if you want to remain part of that church, then you have to become
you have to practice subsidiarity.
Yes. Subsidiarity.
Yes.
I don't know why I'm having trouble with that word.
That's okay.
I normally don't have trouble with words, because I keep thinking about subsidiary, because I have a subsidiary. I own one, so I know what it means. Basically, one of my labels is subsidiary to my main label.
Mm-hmm.
So subsidiarity. You have to have subsidiarity to the hierarchy.
Yes.
Well, that creates problems. because suddenly you are reliant not upon the workings of the grassroots as guided by the presbytery.
Mm-hmm.
You are operating from diktat from the top down on spiritual matters. This is part of the reason why there is a United States of America, Barry. The Pilgrims and the Puritans both came here to escape diktat from the church headed by the king and run by his archbishop, the Archbishop of Canterbury, who implemented his wishes. So if the king wanted, for instance, to outlaw the Geneva Bible, he could do that and replace it with what? The King James Version. Why did he do that? He did that because he did not like the liner notes in the Geneva Bible because it questioned the top-down authority of the king in the church. He didn't like that. He liked having control of the church. And one of the reasons we haven't had an American Revolution was because the king attempted to impose a bishop on even the protesting churches in the United States of America. Catholics, Congregationalists, Presbyterians, Quakers, Lutherans, even people outside, you know, the normal structures.
Yep.
Were going to be required to answer to an Anglican bishop. And everybody said, hold on a minute. That's not going to happen here. Now, that's, again, we've mentioned it before. That's the forgotten spark plug for the American Revolution. Nobody wants to talk about that for obvious reasons.
Right.
Because it goes to the point that we were making at the beginning, separation of church and state. The church can have all the influence it needs to have on the state. The state cannot have influence over the church, period.
Right. Well, and you know, Catholic scholars would argue that by subsidiarity, they mean that the nothing should be done, and I'm taking this from a quote from the Acton Institute, nothing should be done by a larger, more complex organization which can be done as well by a smaller and simpler organization. Except that's not the current Catholic teaching. That is the historic viewpoint on it. But the current Catholic teaching comes from with the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops and other bishops, Monsignor George Higgins's view of it that he gave as a lecture series here about 20 years ago. And he said basically that the principle of subsidiarity is concerned with the relationship of the state to other societies, not with the nature of the state itself. So it doesn't matter how big the state gets and doesn't matter how much control it really takes, as long as they are cooperating with other societies, it's perfectly okay, which is the reason why in Pope Francis's yes. world and in the world of this subsidiarity, and not the limited government, you know, free market ideas of many, like G.K. Chesterton, Hilary Belloc, and others of the Catholic persuasion. The only reason that the bishops opposed Obamacare was because of the abortion mandate, not because of the fact the government was going to take over health care.
Exactly. No, they were all, in fact, I believe the Conference of Bishops and the nuns, a number of orders of nuns, were all for the healthcare takeover. They just didn't want to have to contribute to abortions.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, this particular pope seems to be sidestepping that issue.
Well, you know, he sidestepped that particular issue, but on another point, he's going right to the heart, Chuck. Because, and there was a quote that in his speech to Congress, and he said this, and he said, if politics must truly be at the service of the human person, it follows that it cannot be a slave to the economy and finance. In other words, you can't have free market capitalism. That's really what he's getting down to here. Politics is instead, he says, an expression of our compelling need to live as one in order to build as one the greatest common good. That of a community which sacrifices particular interests in order to share in justice and peace its goods, its interests, its social life. And he says, I do not underestimate the difficulty that this involves, but I encourage you in this effort. In other words, we're talking about government acting as the force of engine of force to make sure that everybody lives as one and has the greatest common good, i.e., everybody is radically equal, Chuck. And there's only one way to do that, and he points it out. You have to sacrifice particular interests, well, which is code word for get rid of the free market, have government controls on everything, and everybody's guaranteed a certain wage, and everybody's guaranteed certain benefits and certain entitlements, but nobody has the right to profit off anything.
Okay. Hey, I'm going to, since the key word there seems to be share.
Share. That's right.
Okay.
Share.
Let's talk about sharing for a minute. Is it really sharing if somebody sticks a knife in your back and says, let's have your wallet, takes everything out of it and hands it out?
Well, you know what? We don't even have to go that far. We can just talk about kids. If you had more than one child, if you're a parent, everybody was a parent with more than one child, you know that sometimes you had to step in with the force of law to force a child to share their toys or whatever it might be with their siblings. Let's say you came home and you said, hey, I've got cookies for everybody. And one of the siblings ran in and grabbed all the cookies and took off. And the other sibling, Mom, he stole my cookies. Well, sometimes you had to step in and say, wait a minute, those cookies are for both of you. Now, that's a legitimate means of using a third party to create...
As a referee
to create a just situation. However, let's say that the cookies were bought by the older child. And the older child comes home and the younger child grabs the bag of cookies and takes them off and says, well, you got to share. Does he have to?
Absolutely not.
No, he doesn't have to because he bought them. You know, the older child bought the cookies. Now, if mom steps in and says, no, son, you must give half your cookies to your little brother and has no intention of making the older child whole from the money that they spent on the product for themselves, what is that called?
It's called socialism.
It's called socialism. It's called injustice. It's called, as Scripture talks about, you know, having your child be frustrated with you. In other words, your discipline and correction of your children as a parent, as an authority, is not supposed to lead to them being frustrated and thus violating God's word.
Yeah.
But yet that's exactly what, when we move it to the geopolitical scale, it's exactly what government coming in and forcing everybody to... You can't have that. I'm going to take that away from you and give it to somebody else.
Here's the problem let's go back to your child example.
Sure.
The older child has decided that part of his disposable income that he got from his selling his labor.
Right. Paper route, whatever it might be.
Whatever he did. Pumping gas, although kids don't do that anymore. I did. That kind of thing. Washing cars, whatever. Part of his disposable income was to go to cookies. He sold his time and his labor, and he saw fit to trade some of that for cookies. The younger sibling saw what the older one had done and said, that's not fair. I should have that too. That's a goodie. I should be able to partake of that just simply from the fact that I exist and I'm his brother or his sibling. So, what problem do we run into? We have a government now that basically says, well, you you won the genetic lottery. That's a term that's floating around. You won the genetic lottery. You have talent and ability to do this thing that someone else can't do. Well, who controls the genetic lottery?
God does.
For some reason, not everybody's capable of being a CEO of a multi-billion-dollar multinational corporation. Not everybody's built that way. I'm certainly not. Would I love to make $1 billion a year and have jets and whatever else, you know, pools and hotels?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, sure. That would be okay. And then I think about it and I'm like, it sounds too much like work. No, really, it sounds like too much work. But the idea is that I don't then turn around and say, well, you need to give me some of that.
Right. You don't do that.
That is the difference between a free market capitalist and a socialist. We understand that there is a payoff. There are rewards and penalties. So in other words, there's a penalty to me because I'm not willing to put in 23 hours a day of work, that I'm not going to make $1 million a year. And I'm not going to have a Ferrari, and I'm not going to have three houses, you know, in different parts of the world, and I'm not going to be able to fly my own jet. And you know what? I'm okay with that. But somebody else may look at it and say, well, I should have that advantage. A socialist looks at it and says, I should have that advantage without having to put in the labor.
Right.
That's the difference. In other words, it's jealousy.
Yes, it is.
Socialism is based on envy.
Right.
Which is a sin.
It is a sin.
And why doesn't the Pope point that out?
Well, because the Pope is too busy using words to obfuscate the true meaning.
What it is. Yeah.
Because if you listen carefully, and again, this is something we teach in our Institute on the Constitution courses, he gives a definition or kind of a roundabout way of defining what he believes politics is all about. He says, if politics must truly be at the service of the human person, well, first of all, folks, even in an imperfect world, we know politics isn't at the service of any other human persons other than the political class. Okay? So in just a real world, you know, rough and tumble example, the Pope is trying to change the definition. And then he also says, politics is instead an expression of our compelling need to live as one in order to build as one the greatest common good. That's not what politics is either.
No.
Because, and this is what we teach in our classes of the Webster 1828 Dictionary, because this is the definition that our founders believed when they used the term politics. And frankly, it's still a valid definition today. It's just out of use. And that the fact that politics is the science of government, it's that part of ethics, which consists in the regulation and government of a nation or state for the preservation of its safety, peace, and prosperity. Oh, wait a minute. That doesn't sound like redistribution of wealth. That sounds like everybody being free to be able to be the best they can be individually, not as everybody being boiled down into a single pot to be a single unit as one, as he's saying, for the common good. Comprehending the defense of its existence and rights against foreign control or conquest, the augmentation of its strength and resources, and the protection of its citizens in their rights. With the preservation and improvement, not of their common good, but of their morals. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, our founders believed that politics was part of ethics, which was concerned with improving our morals. Now, maybe the Pope would say he would agree with that statement, only if our morality was to social justice and the redistribution of wealth. But that is not how politics has been defined by our founders, because they knew better. They knew that if you're going to have a strong and vibrant nation, it has to be one whose morality is grounded in the absolute truth of God's word, and where people are secure in their rights and free to pursue their interests and exchange in free markets. Because that's where growth and human flourishing happens, not in government programs and diktats that pick winners and losers, that say you didn't build that, so you can't take any credit for it or profit from it, and you must be forced into charity at the point of a gun. But that is truly what is implied by this statement before Congress.
Okay, he's been even more explicit in the past. Now, I pulled up an article from our good friend and friend of Camp American, Joel McDermott, down at American Vision. And he wrote an article that's named, Yes, Pope Francis is a Socialist.
Well, yes.
And from this, I'm going to give you a little quote. So bear with me. Whether something wears the label of communist or socialist or liberal or not doesn't matter. What matters is substance of their social ethics. As I argue throughout God versus Socialism, available through us here at in our bookstore.
Yes, it is.
The moment the state begins to redistribute wealth for any reason other than punishment for crime, and that only in very specified ways, in other words, recovery of the victims, it is defying the biblical doctrine of private property, defying biblical law, defying God. I label such activity by the state socialism, and I argue it applies across the board whether any given version of the practice meets certain technical definitions of socialism, communism, liberation theology, etc., used by some today. In other words, you are not allowed to define socialism away. All right. I don't care about the labels. I care about the substance. So I get my jimmies rustled a bit when I hear this self-proclaimed not a communist advocating socialist doctrines, which he euphemistically terms legitimate redistribution of economic benefits by the state. This came during a brief speech before world leaders at the UN agency's funds and programs group last May, that's May of 2014, where Francis called for equitable development by aforementioned means. His full comments go like this. Quote, I do not hesitate to state that equitable economic and social progress can only be attained by joining scientific and technical abilities with an unfailing commitment to solidarity. Accompanied by a generous and disinterested spirit of gratuitousness at every level. So in other words, in order to be successful, you have to be disinterested. Has that ever worked ever?
Not to my understanding.
A contribution to this equitable development will also be made both by international activity aimed at the integral human development of all the world's peoples and by, quote, the legitimate redistribution of economic benefits by the state as well as indispensable cooperation between the private sector and civil society. Barry, what's that called?
That's called socialism.
Socialism.
That is a textbook definition of socialism. Now, he keeps going on with this, Chuck, in his speech before Congress. And he basically talks about this. He says, I would encourage you, as he was talking about as he was attacking the foundation of, you know, capitalism. And, of course, there is immoral capitalism and there's moral capitalism. And we strive for moral capitalism and free markets when we try to avoid immoral capitalism. You know, immoral capitalism is I'm going to rake you for every cent I can get out of you, and I right. don't care what it does to you. So that's not the kind of capitalism we're talking about, and that's not the kind of capitalism that actually built the country. But he says this. He goes, I would encourage you to keep in mind all those people around us who are trapped in a cycle of poverty. It goes without saying that part of this great effort is the creation and distribution of wealth.
In other words, free market capitalism.
Well, yes, if that's where you're coming from.
Okay, what is the basic tenet of Marxist theory? How does Marxism work?
It works on other people's money. Well, it's from each okay. according to his ability to each according to his need.
Marx was clear that in order for communism to work, there had to be a period of free market capitalism in order to, quote unquote, build the capital necessary to allow the system to continue to operate. In other words, Marxism required free market capitalism to create capital. Capital is created. Whenever you take an ore out of the earth, can you make a car out of iron ore?
Well, not directly, no.
That's my point. What do you do?
It takes a number of steps in between, those intermediate steps, to go from the iron ore to the iron horse.
How valuable is iron ore simply pulled from the ground and allowed to lay?
It's only valuable to those who know what to do in the intermediate okay. steps in order to make it profitable.
Dr. Thomas Woods talks about an article he saw where a man decided at one point to He was going to build a toaster from scratch.
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So he started gathering parts, and some stuff he actually had to have custom made. And in the end, his $12 toaster that, you know, you can walk into Big Lots or into
pick up a toaster for $10 or $12
cost about $400, and it took him nine and a half months or a year to build.
Okay.
Okay. So, what was the whole point of that? Well, is that toaster worth $400 plus a year of his time?
Only if he believes it to be so, because actually value is in the eye of the beholder.
The capital, the capital to build toasters was created by someone else.
That's true.
Who creates toasters and distributes them for $12.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are other people who also have toaster technology and toaster capital built, who will, if he decides to sell his toaster for $24, will undercut him and sell it for $16. And somebody else will come along and say, $16 is too expensive. I can build that thing and make money and pay my workers and still have a decent amount for myself for $12.
Exactly. That's called competition.
That's right. That's free market capitalism.
And that's the beauty of the model is, now I saw a little comment the other day on Facebook, and yeah, I probably spend way too much time on Facebook. Apologize. But I saw this point the other day because the left is in an uproar right now because you had a hedge fund venture capitalist who bought a company that was distributing a drug that is for HIV/AIDS treatment. Okay? And before he bought the company, the drug was being sold for approximately $13 a tablet. $13.50, I think. He bought the company and immediately raised the price on this drug to $750 a unit.
A unit, yeah.
Okay?
A dose.
Yep. And everybody's screaming that this is the fault of capitalism. You know, we got these guys and they're just profit takers and they're harming people by not allowing them to get their drugs for free. But then somebody pointed out something, said, no. See, you're blaming the wrong source because it's not capitalism. It's the fact that the government gave a monopoly on this particular drug through the FDA trials and through holding everybody else out of the market, so that when this person bought it and decided that, well, you know what, I believe a better market number for this because nobody else has it is what I feel like, $750, that's not a capitalist problem. That's a control socialist problem because it was the government that came in and created the monopoly.
That's exactly why this is one of the problems you run into. Now, there's another issue there. Apparently, the patent for this drug ran out years ago.
Years ago.
Which means that other companies can swoop in and make it generic. So, why don't they? No profit in it.
Right.
No profit in it. Now, I my doctor for some reason wants me to be on brand name drug for my thyroid, thinking that the controls are a little better and blah, 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 blah. Well, it hasn't made any difference at all, but it cost me twice as much.
Sure.
I'm basically going in and saying, put me back on the generic. This is out-of-pocket expense, and this is another place. We've had socialized medicine in this country for years. People didn't realize it. It's under the auspices of so-called, quote-unquote, private insurance. People don't know what things cost. My doctor didn't know what things cost. I came in. I ran into a situation like that. She said, we're going to try a new diabetes drug on you. And so she gave me a couple samples of the thing, you know, a few days worth. And I went home and yeah, the control was very good. Fine. She says, I'm going to write you a prescription for it. So she writes me a 90-day prescription, you know, assuming that I'm going to turn it into insurance. And I'm like, well, we don't do things that way because I'm self-pay. So I go into the drugstore after she's called this thing in and I said, okay, I'm here for my prescription. Oh, no, it's not done yet. It's on hold. I go, it's on hold. What's the problem? They said, well, 90 days worth is $1,800.
Oh, my heavens. Oh, I would say, well, how about 9/10 of a day?
Yeah. And I said, really? And I said, okay, how about 30 days worth? You know, I can do math, but.
Right, yeah.
You know, and they quote me the price that's actually a little more expensive per unit.
Oh,
and
sure.
So I said, okay, well, don't worry about it. You can put it back. We're not going to be getting that filled. So I went back to the doctor and I said, okay, doctor's problem. And she said, well, what's that? And I said, you know, this drug that you wrote me the prescription for. I said, do you have any idea what it costs? And she said, no. And I said, well, it was $1,800 for 90 days worth. And she's like, what? She didn't know either. Because insurance companies just pay for it. And you pay a $10 copay or a $15 copay or maybe even a $20 copay. And then the insurance company wrestles it out with the pharmacy over what they'll actually pay, which is not $1,800, but it's also
not even close.
It's not that much less. Okay, what happened there? Well, she didn't know. The doctor didn't know. Only the pharmacist knew what it actually cost, because the pharmacist was going to be taking it on the chin from the insurance company, who wasn't going to pay him that much for it.
Right.
There's no intervening insurance company. Now, what did that do to the cost of insurance? Those kinds of things run the cost of insurance up. People
yes,
are
do.
Now squawking who got their Obamacare and said, look how cheap it is. And now they're seeing a doubling of the prices. There's a reason that you're seeing doubling of the prices. You can't cover every condition, pre-existing or not, and have the price stay low.
That's right. You cannot do it.
Unless you force doctors into some form of servitude. Which is what you have in the National Health Service in Britain. Can doctors do something other than be a doctor? Yes. So if you have a calling to be a doctor, though, you're kind of stuck. Which is why sometimes when you go into the emergency room in Britain and folks coming to an emergency room near you, you walk into an emergency room in Britain, and if it's shift change and there's not a doctor schedule or the doctor has called off at 5 o'clock, and you're in the emergency room, you're on your own. Because doctors don't hang around because they don't make any more money. They're salaried. Once they're salaried, they go home. There's
right.
no incentive for them to stay.
No, there wouldn't be.
So once you take the free market, you have to have an incentive for people who are entrepreneurial to do what they will do. The Pope is in one side of his mouth paying homage to that. And really what he's doing is laying out Marxist theory without you knowing it, saying we have to build the capital to make the communism run.
Right. And that's true Marxist theory. And that's the reason why I find it not surprising that Barack Obama is saying how much we cherish religious liberty and the Pope is talking about how much we have to build capital, because ultimately neither one of them actually believe it in the way that the rest of us believe that.
The words don't mean the same thing.
Welcome to Postmodernism 101.
That's right. Equivocation, it's a logical fallacy. And we now have a society built on postmodernism.
Yes, we do, as a matter of fact. Interesting, I just gave a presentation to a county group here a couple of days ago about this issue, about where our real law comes from, where our basis is. And that question was brought up in the audience about, well, you know, they say this, they don't mean that. Yeah, it's like, well, that's because words don't have fixed meanings according to these type of folks. And that speech in front of Congress, I encourage people to go look it up and read it carefully. Don't read it and read it for what it says. Read it for what it says.
As Joel McDermott demonstrated, read it with your ears on, really perked up, or your eyes, your internal ears, and listen for the words and ask yourself, what did he really mean by that? Well, guess what, Barry? We're out of time for this week. We'll ask you to come out to our website, www.principledpolicy.com. That's principledpolicy.com. You can hear podcast of this after it airs on WLRY, and we ask that you would join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.